7, reel 10.
Charles Simpson, reel 10. Can you tell me how the wardroom was funded?
Yes, principally by the Navy itself. Stewards were Royal Marines. The bar steward was a Royal Marine. Then there were, in addition, naval stewards. So all the domestic arrangements for the wardroom, like every other part of the ship, were provided by the Royal Navy. So it was only for extra things, entertainment in the wardroom, to which officers had to subscribe. There was not much opportunity in wartime for entertainment, but such as was held, as for example having a dance for wrens on board, were paid for by an addition to your wardroom mess bill.
And how often would you have to pay your mess bill?
Once a month.
And would that include your bar bill as well?
Yes. That would include the amount you had actually spent at the bar. It included laundry, anything you bought at the ship's canteen, like bars of chocolate, and any personal additions like cigarettes, all were handed over the bar without the passage of money, but recorded and then added to your wine bill.
Did everybody always settle their bill at the end of the month?
Yes, you glance at the total and whistled if it was more than you anticipated. I was teetotal and a non-smoker, so my mess bill, I'm only guessing here because I never saw anybody else's, but my guess would be that my personal mess bill was much less than another officer of equal rank. I bought drinks for others because it was a social habit in which it was a great pleasure to join. You stood in a group, and probably each officer in a group in turn would say, "What's yours?" and go to the bar and order it. So although it was my custom to order a soft drink, I would order spirits or beer for the remainder of officers in that particular group.
Were there any formal arrangements for dinner?
Oh, very. Yes, there were opportunities in harbour of having formal meals in the sense that everybody sat down at the same time. The wines were passed at the end of the meal and the Queen's health was drunk. But different to peacetime in that we had no mess dress on board. Whereas in peacetime we would have dressed in a much more elaborate uniform, we sat down even though it was a formal dinner. We sat down in our normal day-to-day uniform, but followed the same procedure. The officers were called to attention before the meal began. and the chaplain was called upon to offer a prayer, and then the meal proceeded with marines and other stewards handing already filled soup plates in the normal formal way. At other times, of course, we went in as our duties permitted. So, in fact, we dribbled into meals, and half the time, the majority of officers were on duty.
Was that at sea, presumably?
Yes.
What happened after dinner? Were there any special traditions?
Yes. When you were having a formal meal, it was under conditions when the likelihood of being called to action were remote. And then the next few hours would be given to fun and games. And there were traditional games for wardroom officers to play. And somebody, probably with great more audacity than most of us, would organise a series of games.
What sort of games?
A favourite was to line several dining tables in line. And then a combatant in the competition would stand as far away from the end of the nearest table as he possibly could, and then run as fast as he could until he reached the edge of the table, when he would fling himself upon the table, and the game was to see how far you could progress along these two or three very long tables.
So you were sliding along the table?
Yes.
On your tummy?
Yes. My commander E used to have a favourite story of doing this in another ship, which he joined the day before his appointment began. This was the tradition. So that on the day you actually began your appointment, at 9 o'clock you were ready to meet the captain. So you asked permission to join the ship the day before. And my new commander had a favourite story, which was he joined his ship, they indulged in this game, he flung himself upon the table and tables and fell off the end and broke his leg. And so he was invalided out of the ship and was in hospital for a month. And when he actually joined on the day following his arrival, the captain's first words were, "Why are you 4 weeks late?" The captain, already being aware, of course, that he'd fallen off the table 4 weeks beforehand.
What other sort of games did you play in the wardroom?
A great favourite was to sit upon an ordinary hard chair and then circumvent the chair by going behind it. You had to curl yourself round the back of the chair without upsetting the chair. And you'd be cheered on, of course, as you made the attempt. You sat on the chair and then curled yourself in the back of it. Another one was to kneel upon the floor and then reach out with a bottle in your hand. And the winner, of course, was the one who was able to stretch the furthest and put his bottle, still standing, on the floor. I've played this at home hundreds of times.
Any other games?
Well, yes. There were the usual childish games. You might even do Blind Man's Buff. How quickly one could drink a foaming glass of beer. Everybody does these sort of games, even in pubs at home. Mostly childish, but very great fun.
Can you perhaps remember any of the characters in the mess? Any stories about any of the other officers?
My commander E.
What was his name?
He was Esmond. Well known throughout the service as being a great character. He came from the Irish Free State, which was neutral during the war. But he was very proud of being an Irishman. He had an ancestor who was the third officer to win a Victoria Cross during the Crimean War. And he had a brother who was the officer commanding a squadron of Swordfish aircraft who led an abortive attack on three German cruisers who were attempting to run up the English Channel to a more secure place in Germany. And his brother, Lieutenant Commander Esmond, was killed in the attack and was awarded a posthumous Victoria Cross. Sometime later, Winston Churchill made one of his famous speeches. And whenever this occurred, the ship went still, silent, and everybody gathered round the nearest loudspeaker. All the wardroom officers attended in the wardroom, and we listened in utter silence. Now, the Irish Free State had allowed German submarines to use their Atlantic seaports. And Winston Churchill, in his speech, condemned this as being unfairly to the rest of Great Britain. At which remark, Commander Esmond stamped, obviously in great rage, out of the wardroom. A second after he left, Winston Churchill turned his remarks to those men and officers from the Irish Free State who had distinguished themselves, and he referred to Commander Esmond's brother as having died in this attack and had been granted a Victoria Cross. So he missed the opportunity of hearing the Prime Minister refer to his brother as a hero.
Any other stories about people in the wardroom?
Yes. The captain himself. The captain paid great attention to the morale of the ship, as most good captains do. And he had the brilliant idea of awarding a certificate, a pretend certificate, to every member of the ship's company, commemorating the fact that the ship had entered the Arctic Circle sometime during the preceding months. And he had this certificate produced in traditional manner with a picture of King Neptune on the top, and with a proclamation in traditional Old English lettering. To all seamen, wherever you may be, greetings. Nobody's presence that, and then a name was inserted with a rank, did appear in the northernmost reaches of my realm, embarked in HMS Belfast. And then it matted, mentioned the latitude and longitude. And the captain signed every certificate, and every member of the ship's company got a copy. And it was hereafter referred to as the Blue Nose Certificate.
Did he present the certificate?
No. He was not only the commanding officer, remember, he was also on the Admiral's staff. And I imagine he took some very precious hours of his duties to sign these certificates in person. But he was an exceptionally busy man.
There must have been over 1,000 certificates.
Oh, yes. Well, certainly several hundreds. I'm not quite sure what our full wartime complement was. Yes.
Any other stories about...
Yes, you'd like to hear a story about the Royal Marine Bandmaster. My cabin was in the Admiral's cabin flat, and this was a very secure place for the captain to see all defaulters and requestmen. And I had occasion to go to my cabin when the captain was seeing defaulters, and to my astonishment, the man in front of the captain's desk, being treated as a defaulter, was the bandmaster. Now, he happened to have become a friend of mine because I had a great interest in music. And so I took the opportunity later on to say in utter astonishment, "Why were you a defaulter?" And he said, "The captain of Marines charged me with an offence in that the Royal Marine Band did not produce lively music outside the wardroom on a guest night." So I said, "What did you say to the captain in defence?" He said, and here I quote, "As the bandmaster, I can order a member of the band to play E flat for 5 beats, and he will produce a precise E flat. I can likewise order him to play a number of music, a number of notes, naming each note to a certain time, and he will play them perfectly. But I cannot order my band to play outside the wardroom with spirit. Music is produced from the soul, and you cannot order a Royal Marine Bandsman to play with his soul." He said, "The majority of my band are not regulars. They are full time only, and their forte and passion as musicians is to play what we now call pop. They have no great interest in playing a selection from Rosemary." And I said, "And what was your sentence?" "The captain dismissed me."
Any other stories about the captain?
Yes.
Captain Parnham.
Yes. The long time after the war, the captain was appointed in command of a brand new battleship, HMS Vanguard. And the HMS Vanguard took the royal family to South Africa. And I was by then in HMS Triumph, and together with other ships in company, we manned ship to cheer ship as the Vanguard passed by. I wrote to the captain, the only captain in my career I ever wrote to as a person, and congratulated him on being in command of this magnificent ship. To which he replied that he had often met members of the HMS Belfast after the war, when his principal duty was to wish them well before being demobilised. And he said, what good those sometimes grim times they were in the Belfast. And no matter how proud I may become in command of the Vanguard, she will never displace my affection in the Belfast.
Can you tell me about your views about the captain and his effectiveness as a leader?
In wartime, personal contacts with the captain are very rare, and this was particularly so in Belfast because he had two duties to perform, not only in command, but he was the Admiral's chief staff officer. He came by invitation to the war room, and that was not very often. So, my contacts with him personally were very few. But there was one quite unique occasion. In fact, yes, there were two. The ship's company had a canteen committee. Profits from the canteen were ploughed back into the ship's fund and devoted to things to benefit the ship's company. One of the executive commander was president of the canteen committee, and one commissioned officer was added to the committee, and I became that officer. And after the meeting, I was required to go on the ship's broadcast system and report to the entire ship's company what the proceedings were at the canteen committee, tell them how the money was to be disposed. And because they were to do with the profits from the canteen, on the very first occasion, I addressed the ship's company as customers. And the captain sent for me afterwards and said that whilst he thought my broadcast was no less than excellent, he approved every word except customers. He thought it was undignified and not worthy of the ship. And in effect, he advised me to begin every subsequent broadcast about the canteen committee as Welcome Belfast. The second occasion was after the visit of His Majesty the King, who was to inspect all personnel on the upper deck. We were ranged in our departments, and I was in charge of the stoker's department. The visit of all royalties were timed to the minute, and the commander preceded the monarch and indicated where his passage along your division was to be slowed down or speeded up. Now, we were ordered before the inspection to place men of our departments in different ranks so that the Majesty, His Majesty's attention could be drawn to a particular person. The King approached and proceeded along the front rank. He stopped in front of a stoker and said, "When were you in the Palestine Police Force?" Which was something I was quite unaware of, because, like everybody else who happened to have medals, this stoker for the first time was wearing a medal, which I deduced afterwards the king had recognised. So he had a few words with the stoker about his service in Palestine. He went to the second rank, stopped in front of a stoker and said, "You were in the royal yacht, were you not? Are you hoping to return?" To which the stoker, "Of course," replied, "Very much, sir." He said, "I hope to meet you then, after the war." He proceeded to the third rank. I had in the third rank a member of the Free French Forces who had joined the Royal Navy from Free part of France under false names. This particular stoker was a West African. His face was coal black, and he spoke only French. The captain stopped there, I beg your pardon. The king stopped in front of him and addressed him in English. So I stepped forward and said, "He speaks only French, sir." At which the king changed to French and spoke several sentences to this black sailor. The sailor eyeballs went scarlet and his black cheeks glowed with redness. The king proceeded to the end of my ranks, and then he did a most unusual thing. He turned and spoke to me and said, "How does he get on with the others?" And I said, "Exceptionally well, sir. When he fails to appear at a mealtime, they go and find him. When they go ashore, they take him with them and they protect him from any remarks that might be made about his colour." I said that they look after him. They teach him his duties. He said, "I am very glad to hear it." And then, having received my salute, he went off. Not long after he left the ship, I had returned to my cabin, and a seaman came to say the captain wished to see me. I went to the captain's cabin, and he said, "What did the monarch say to you?" I said, "He inquired after the well-being of the stoker. And the captain said, is it not remarkable that the King of England should spare a thought for a black stoker in time of war?
When was that visit, and where did it take place?